Creation Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. Hanna Baba, the award-winning host of Cross Currents on KALW and co-host of the groundbreaking podcast The Stoop, grew up in much the same way as her baby sister, Ethar, who we spoke to last week, by splitting her time between Khartoum, Sudan, and the U.S. Now that she's all grown up with a family of her own, the concept of home is complicated, as it stirs up feelings of longing for different places depending on where she is at that moment. Her experience being raised in wildly different environments has given her a profound desire to live in diverse, multicultural areas, and, I think, a drive to explore the complexities of the cultures that we inhabit through her work as a journalist. Her podcast, The Stoop, is an expression of this, as she and her co-host Leela Day tackle issues surrounding blackness, race, and identity in America through the eyes of the black diaspora. I'm really thankful for Hanna for not only taking the time out of her schedule to talk with me, but for inviting me into the KALW studios to record our chat. You'll hear me sing its praises in the show, so I won't lump on more here, but you should definitely check out The Stoop. I've got links in the show notes where you can learn more. But before you do that, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Hanna Baba. Hanna Baba, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you.
Where is home?
Home is where my family is, and I think it's where my husband and children are, because home for me is many places, but I think the place that is that most feels like home to me is wherever they are.
Wherever they are. Has that shifted a lot? Where are they now?
They are here in California.
Okay.
Which is where we are. Yeah. So what they say, home is where the heart is.
Are they in this studio somewhere? Can I not see them? Are they hiding?
Everybody's kind of in their world, but we always, you know, at the end of the day, come back together. And that's just like the feeling of home. But I mean, if I'm talking about a larger sense of home, home is two places for me. It's Sudan and it's the U.S. because I've kind of lived in both, you know, not equal number of years, but in Sudan, I lived kind of my formative years. But I have lived in the U.S. for many more, like, years. I consider myself, I'm comfortable there, I'm comfortable here. When I'm here, I miss there. When I'm there, I miss here. So that question is one of the hardest questions to ask me.
I'm still astounded that I always get different answers. Every single person I've asked this question, I get a different answer.
Nobody just says, like, Long Island, and that's it.
Well, only one person has immediately said a single place. It's like Bethesda, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And he just said it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why? I was, like, stunned, because usually there's all this vacillating and qualifying. And he said, that's where my parents are. That's where I'm from,
You know?
And I respect that, but I am just still stunned by how many different answers I get. And doesn't matter how long someone's in a place, doesn't matter how strongly they feel connected to any one place, there's always just this complex thing that's going on whenever we ask someone of our tribe, maybe, people who are of multiple places or live, you know, away from where they originated. It's just something that happens with that where is home just gets very complicated.
It is complicated, though, because it's about feelings. It's about heritage sometimes for some people. It's about where you feel most comfortable for other people. So I would imagine that it's not an easy answer.
Yeah.
So good for, it's one good of the for that guy, the Bethesda, Maryland.
Way to go, Abe. How did you get from Sudan over to the U.S.? What was that like? Was that your choice or were you taken?
I was taken.
Yes.
So a couple of steps. My parents were in Sudan when they married, but right after they got married, they moved to Saudi Arabia, which a lot of people in Sudan and Africa overall, East Africa, end up in one of these other countries for opportunities, whether it's Saudi Arabia or like the Emirates, one of these Arab countries. And so my parents ended up there and they had me there. And then the opportunity came to come to the U.S. So I came to the U.S. when I was 8 months old.
Oh, wow.
I was a baby.
Cool. We spoke with your sister and she missed that part totally. She was just born in America. And
yeah.
I say just like it's, like it's boring. She was born in America. So it was kind of interesting to hear you give a little more on that. So you came over when you were 8 months old. So did you have any experience growing up in Sudan? Were you back and forth or just in the U.S.?
So we came when I was 8 months old and we lived here. again, that question of home or where are you from is very interesting, because my parents, when they came to Indianapolis, Indiana. Then they moved to Houston, Texas. So we lived there for another, 5 years. And then, I was like 10 in fifth grade when my parents made the decision to pick up and move back to Sudan. And I think that decision was because at that time, Houston, Texas was not very diverse in terms of there were no Sudanese, people. There was not a big Muslim community even. I think my parents felt that maybe we needed kind of a dose of culture and a dose of getting to know our family, and that we were just in this faraway land. This was the 80s, the mid 80s, no internet, no WhatsApp.
It was a lot harder to move back then.
I think they were isolated. Like they felt isolated. You couldn't just pick up the phone and call your mom. So they made the very brave. I think part of it also was that I was growing up, right? And there's this fear among many migrants, and specifically, I think, from conservative communities, that coming to America, has its good, but also has its bad, right?
I want to just interject there for a moment. This is something that has come up with a few of the experts I've spoken with about TCKs. It is a struggle for no matter what class, quote, in quotation marks, class or ethnic origin or country of origin, when they have kids in a third country, there is this incredible struggle with how, if you're an American, will my son or daughter be American if they're growing up in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. And how do you mitigate that, or how do you give your child the same sense of identity or cultural identity or affinity or religion or whatever? How do you give your child that which you value and recognize as part of you? The way I've come back to that, or the way I've thought about that, I've had some conversations with some teachers I've talked about in this show, is that, when we think about that, maybe the way your parents thought the same thing, they're identifying those things about themselves and they're identifying them as good, as important. But for a child, whatever's happening is normal. Mm-hmm. They don't know that it's, quote, not good to not grow up that way. So it's almost like as adults, we are imposing this value system of what you need to feel a sense of identity and belonging on these children who are growing up in this different environment. And to them, it's just different.
I think there's a level of guilt there. I brought them here, and I'm expecting them to also kind of carry my culture also. There's something there, I think, that's very – psychologists, I bet, are all over this idea that I change places, and yet I want my children to be of my culture as if they lived back home in my country, and that's not going to happen. And I think that's why a lot of people struggle with that. Like I was saying, specifically, conservative – communities, societies, you come here and there's these stereotypes over here also, right? Oh, she's going to turn out, she's going to be sassy. She's going to talk back. We don't talk back, right? She's going to, have a boyfriend, right? Like that's like the ultimate fear. And so I think for my family, I was going into middle school. And
that's when the dangerous stuff happens.
That's when,
the ideas get put in your head.
Hey. And they made this very, very brave decision that I don't think I could make even right now in this age, to just move back to Sudan, at least for a time. And I must say, I'm going to say this, they didn't tell us we were moving back.
Really?
Ooh.
Whoa.
They told us we're going on vacation.
Just vacate for a few years.
But then I started noticing some things. Like, we would go and buy all of this furniture. We didn't used to buy furniture when we were going on vacation.
When you went to Disney, you didn't buy an apartment, no. Empty apartment and fill it with
furniture. Even when we went to Sudan, because we did go to Sudan a couple of times, but we would, pack our bags and go. But there were, couches and a washer and dryer. And then they showed us where all this furniture was going to go. We went to the port of Houston where there was a big container. So those were hints as to what was going to happen.
How old were you at the time?
I was 10 going on 11.
See, this is when you start to figure stuff out. You're like, okay.
They're not tricking me.
Yeah, exactly. I've been around the block.
Yeah. So I was the oldest. I had had one, two, three of my younger brothers were born at that time. And we went back to Sudan and lived there for the next 10 years.
10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow is right. Yeah.
Yeah. I was, you know, it was interesting at first, you know. We're little. My siblings are little, so they're looking for, like, where's the Chuck E. Cheese and, you know, where's the Burger King? But, you know, just looking back, I really wouldn't change that experience for anything.
I was actually just going to ask you if you look back at that and see it as a positive.
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, they made a point to have us live close to our extended family. To grandmas and aunties and cousins.
And you knew them anyway from your trips back.
We kind of knew them. And so that was like the first good move, that we were surrounded by people and they were fascinated by us. All of the people that came from America, you know, and we were kind of the center of attention. And then we got to know everybody. And the second good thing was that they enrolled us in an English school. Which was another big deal, was that I think for them that we weren't speaking the language, which is another big migrant expat issue, is are they going to lose the language? So, yeah, we lived there for many years, and I came back after college.
You went to college in Sudan?
I did.
Wow.
I did.
In Khartoum?
In Khartoum, University of Khartoum.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So what brought you back?
So I studied law, but in my third year of law school, I got bitten by the journalism bug.
I was just going to say that law degree really funnels you right into public radio.
I mean, radio was huge in that part of the world. And everybody, you know, that was the main source of news, of entertainment for a long time. Everybody listens to BBC all the time and Radio Monte Carlo and, you know, just to get their international news. And so I was just listening to the local news one evening. And when it ended, this English news bulletin started. And I realized that, like, the local station has an English service. Yeah. And I just joined them. I started training with them. And I did get my law degree. I did finish. But that's it. From that day on, I was enamored by media, mass communications and media and radio. And in Sudan, I think one of the main reasons that I left was there wasn't that that desire to make media in a free way was absent. I remember in our news room when, you know, at night the government security guy would come and want to look at the news bulletin and, you know, the censor, right? And make sure everything is A-okay by them and there's no real, like, reporting. And I would listen to BBC and, like, I want to do that. I think that's one of the big reasons why I came here. Opportunity. Yeah.
Where did you come to when you came to the U.S.?
So my brother, one of my brothers had come here before me. So he was in Virginia, Northern Virginia. A lot of people are in that D.C. area, the DMV, as they call it, D.C., Maryland, Virginia. So I came and joined him. And actually, a couple of years after that, my family came and joined us as well. So they had another kind of America stay again. Like a America part two for them happened.
This is the story. This is the Ethar portion.
This is the Ethar part.
So you're the prequel.
I'm the prequel. This is, yes. She was the sequel.
Yeah. So you come over here and you decide to get into media. And at this point, there is this kind of split in your family. As I've heard from Ethar, when she went back to Sudan, there were three of you who were stayed here in the U.S. And I'm just wondering, first of all, were you all close as a family beforehand? And what did you recognize any kind of interesting, I don't want to say splits because that's negative, but obviously there's a difference that happens when you've got one half of the family on one side of the planet and the other half on the other. I mean, just geographically, if not socially. But it sounds like maybe not, because you went through the same thing she did. You just did it a generation, you know, like 10 years before her or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, time was a big difference. And age-wise, I mean, Ithara was born when I was 17 years old. So there's a big gap there. I'm the oldest, and then there's four boys in the middle, and then she's the youngest.
You bookended it.
So we bookended it, and I think for us it was the top three, the first three and the bottom three. The bottom three were buddies, and up here we were the friends. And it's kind of like, you know how when parents are raising children, the older ones get the tougher discipline.
Oh,
and
do
then
I
by
ever.
The time like number four, number five, number six, Ithara got it so easy. We got all
Mom,
the harsh
turn this
rules.
Part down.
I mean, we got all the harsh rules. We got all the, you know, stuff. And then she's just like flying around the world. Oh, I'm so jealous. I've always been jealous of her.
Hey, I'm the oldest of 17 grandkids. I got two brothers. I was the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. Yeah.
You got it. You got the what? You were the oldest.
I was the oldest. I got the tough assignments. I got the most discipline. I was the learning curve.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's exactly the way it was.
Yeah.
But I think
that alone is an interesting family dynamic. But
right?
But the separation now. Something you said about it came later, and it just triggered in my mind because we mentioned this earlier. When your parents moved, there was no social media, there was no internet, nothing. But by the time Ithara went back and she was growing up over there, you actually had social media and internet. Did you guys utilize that as a family to stay close?
I would say, yeah. But I mean, it was still like in those early days of, it was the early days of internet. So it was email mostly. And so I would say no. I would say there, besides phone calls and some emails, it did feel like we were two families isolated from one another, I think, for a long time. And, you know, and I think the half that was in Sudan was kind of getting what we got when we were in Sudan. So it was like their turn,
right?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Like we got the Sudan kind of part, and then we came back here, and so they were doing their Sudan, you know, almost boot camp, or just like living the life of Sudan, getting like absorbing whatever my parents wanted them to absorb, culture, language, religion, family ties, just like demeanor, whatever it is, and then coming back here. So I feel like we both got the same kinds of things, but like communication between us was, yeah, like until they came back and we all became a family back here, like I had to be kind of reintroduced to Ithar or like my younger siblings, just like, ooh, and what do you like? And let's watch SpongeBob and, you know, just like trying to show interest in the things that they liked. But they were clearly like a clique. The younger three, for sure. I think until this day, like they have their little inside jokes and stuff. And we're like the older, formal, you know, we don't talk a lot kind of people. And they're like, you know, hanging around.
Ithara does love to talk.
You know, and like they're looser for sure with each other. And we got the kind of more rigid, more strict, more formal upbringing. Yeah, so that's why I think she is very close to my daughters now. They love their Aunt Ishu, they call her, Ishu. Yeah, she gets down with them.
Hey, everyone. If you like the kinds of conversations that we have here on Migratory Patterns, you should check out Pop Abroad. Host Michelle Ibarra is on a mission to help expats and migrants live their best lives overseas by talking with the people who are doing it right now. During her first season, she's talking about community, why we need it, how we can use it to get a leg up, and how the best community leaders make theirs work. Listen in as she interviews the incredible women who are killing it overseas to hear how they are creating community in their adopted homes. You can learn more and hear the latest episode at migrationmedia.net or just search for Pop Abroad wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'm a little interested. I'd like to drill down a little bit more into your journey, maybe. So you do a really great podcast I love called The Stoop, and your sister introduced it to me, and I really dig it. it's not for me, but I love it because I feel like a fly on the wall. Like I'm a guy sitting on the next stoop over and I'm kind of listening in, you know, and I'm really digging it. It's opened my eyes to a lot of stuff.
A lot of non-Black people have said that. We get a lot of emails from people saying, thank you. You know, I'm just here to listen and understand.
Yeah.
And I get this now.
It's stuff that, you know, you kind of, when you hear it, you are like, well, of course that's a thing, but you never would have thought of it without... I don't have that experience, so I'm never going to think of it consciously, you know?
Yeah.
But so I'm a little interested because you do a lot of exploration of identity through the lens of, I guess, do you call it the Black diaspora?
Yes.
And I'm wondering what kind of exploration of yourself you've gone through during the show. Like, have you learned anything about yourself by exploring the issues surrounding Black identity?
A lot.
Yeah.
Every episode, I learn something about myself, and I think my co-host Lila Day also does, because we made it a point to put ourselves in this podcast. It's not just we're reporting about other people or stories, which is our bread and butter. That's our job. So it was hard to kind of go from journalist, right, covering other people and being impartial, and to I'm going to put myself in this, and I'm going to put my experience in this. Yeah. I mean, with every episode, I learn something. I think, and that's scary sometimes, right? You know?
I'm having the same experience with the show. I'm learning things about myself.
Yeah.
That it's not that I'm uncomfortable with it, but it's almost like, whoa, I didn't know that was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening to me a lot. And having the conversations that I do with other people who are international migrants or have been through the expat experience or the, you know, some kind of migration, I am constantly surprised at how the feedback I'll get is, oh my God, no one ever talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
One person even told me, I felt alone after this. And it was like the nicest thing anyone ever said to me, but it kind of drilled down to me like, yeah, I guess I was kind of feeling alone too, just because I never talked about it.
Right.
And it's kind of nice to hear you say that about your own show with your own conversations.
For sure. I mean, every time. And we go through so many edits because, I mean, especially at like season one, how am I coming off, right? I'm being very vulnerable. At the same time, I'm the host of this show, this other show. You know, I have like authority. But at the same time, here I am being vulnerable saying,
It's not the NPR voice.
You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, I don't know about this thing, or how do I feel about this thing? Or, you know, they called me this when I was little, you know? And then I think if there's one big thing that I learned about this myself is that you can be both. You can do both, because in journalism, they taught us, you know, don't put yourself in it, right? It's not about you. And now we're realizing, I think, that you can do both at the same time. You can... That human touch, that relatability of story helps journalism, I think. So
I also think in the age of podcasting, or maybe it's just the physical aspect of media, is that you plug it into your head and it's much more personal. So having a more personal connection or a deeper connection is almost a natural extension of how the technology has evolved. It went from a loudspeaker that you held
right.
to something that you put over your ears. Now it's something you put in your ears.
It's intimate.
Yeah, it is.
It's like somebody's talking just to you.
Yeah.
And so
and
you want
listening
that.
Right now, we are talking just to
We're
you.
We're talking just to you, not the other million people that are hopefully listening to this podcast. But because it's intimate, me, even as a listener, I expect truth and I expect, well, you know, just like be you, you know. And that's what's been hard to do, but I think I've been able to break that somehow and keep, you know, go back and wear my journalist hat for this other show that I do.
So one of the things that this is me projecting. I'm going to project my experience onto your experience
Uh-oh.
Now. But one of the things I hear, even though I can't relate to everything you talk about, but I'm learning as I listen, it sounds a lot like, at least from your perspective, when I hear what you're talking about during your show, it almost sounds like the expat experience, a TCK experience, which is kind of what you had growing up, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, you grew up in a culture your parents had moved you to, and then after you had grown up to the point where you were starting your formative years, boom, you're moved to another place. You almost had a TCK experience in both of your, quote, home countries, which is really kind of whacked.
Where do I belong?
I know. I'm a TCK at home.
Yep.
And I'm a TCK
at
home.
I'm a TCK everywhere.
That's right. I would wanted to ask you also about your wearing of a headscarf. Mm-hmm. And that has a certain connotation in America, which we don't need to necessarily get into.
Right.
But I was speaking to Ethar about it a little bit, and we were kind of commenting how in Beijing, it's such a diverse city, because especially the areas that we kind of frequent and gravitate towards. So many diplomats and business people from all around the world. So actually, we were kind of noting that you see every kind of headscarf walking around. You mm-hmm. see the full-on burqa, you see the hijab, you see like your headscarf. I love
it's an international city.
I know. Mm-hmm. I love the way you wear your headscarf because it's like the kind of Iranian. I don't know, is it Iranian style? Is that the right way to say it? That's the way I think about it.
Well, for me, it's just Sudanese style.
Sudanese
this is
style.
How we wear it in Sudan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's very easy breezy.
Yeah.
Colorful.
Yeah, a little bit of hair shown is fine.
You know, it's
very fashionable, I think.
And I think part of it is fashion. I mean, for me, growing up, in Sudan, this is kind of the norm, right? For a young lady, woman walking down the street, she's going to be wearing this most of the time. It's the norm. Historically, Sudanese women wear something like a sari, actually. It's interesting. It's African, but with Indian influences. So we have a long 6-yard piece of fabric called a tobe. And that's what women wore. They wrap it around and then over their heads and they throw it like that.
Wow.
And
just the way you displayed it, I wish you could see it. It looked very like, whoa, yeah.
I'll send you a picture. and you're dolled up, right? Like this. It wasn't meant to bog you down. It wasn't meant to, you know, oppress you or whatever.
It's also freaking hot.
You know what I mean? Well, and it was cotton and it was breezy right. back then and mostly like white, light colors. And then you'd be decked out in your gold and, you know, and the hair and high heels. And so it comes from tradition and it comes from a basis of religion, but it then turns into something that you kind of make your own and you make it your own statement. And hijab now, and we don't even call it hijab back home. It's just like, we just call it a scarf, tarha.
Oh, cool.
And so it takes, I think, different forms and different connotations in different parts of the world. But in Sudan, our kind of quote-unquote version of Islam, I think, is very relaxed and chill compared to a lot of the other parts of the world that are not far from us. I mean, if you just cross the Red Sea and go to Saudi Arabia, huge difference.
Those Wahhabis don't mess around.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, for us, we're... I don't know what examples to give you, but like my mom and dad met in college, fell in love and married that generation in the 70s. So there is a sense of this religion is more cultural. It should be like a natural kind of part of you. And if it doesn't come natural, then it wasn't meant. So it just came natural because I think I lived in Sudan for a long time and these quote unquote formative years, right? So I was a teenager and going into like high school and then college, and this is what everybody wore. And then coming back here, I never thought to take it off.
I was going to ask you if you felt like it meant something else after you came here. Did it feel different to wear it here?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, when you go from a place where everybody does something to a place where not only are you in the minority, but you're in a kind of a shunned minority because of this, right? And then I'm here for a couple of years and 9/11 happens. And so I remember the day of 9/11, my mom calling me and saying, don't leave the house, don't leave the house. Or if you have to leave the house, you know, you don't have to wear the scarf, safety first, that kind of thing. But of course, anybody... I think every woman who wears a scarf, wears hijab, is very aware of what it may mean to somebody on the street, what it may mean to somebody at work, you know. I think it's much better now, though.
I can only imagine what that was like. I mean, as you were saying it, in my brain, I was getting my chest out like the big privileged white guy that I am, be like, 'cause F you, that's why I'm wearing it. Like, yeah. You know, which is easy for me to say. But obviously, it's not how it works for someone, like you said, who's in a minority during a time of heightened tension.
But I will say that's why I think we have consciously lived in very diverse areas. The DC area right now is one of the most diverse areas in the country. Alexandria, Virginia, where my family is now and where I was, huge immigrant populations, specifically from Africa and East Africa, and lots of Muslims on the street. You know, it's not a weird sighting. I moved here to California, to the Bay Area specifically. I'm not anywhere else. And that's also, you know, I feel like that's for a reason as well. I've never, ever felt discriminated against or even looked at funny. To the contrary, you know, it's a place that celebrates everyone. You know?
One of the things I recognized about myself that I didn't know, where I grew up in Boston, I was adjacent to the like kind of all white Irish Catholic neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And I grew up just across the road in the section where it wasn't all white Irish Catholic. I mean, there were a few white families, notably the Wahlbergs. Donnie and Danny lived up the street from me.
Oh.
But little name drop. But no, the very few, and it was mostly minority families and, you know, a lot of violence and crime. And what I didn't realize until I moved overseas was that I really crave that diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, I lived in China where it's kind of a monoculture. Well, not monoculture is the right way. It's super diverse, but it's all Chinese. But where I lived in Beijing is super diverse. I mean, walking down the street, you hear literally 20 languages in the same block.
Mm.
Something about that is just awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I love it. And I really don't want to live anywhere where I can't have that. It's something that I crave. And I didn't know I craved it until I moved overseas.
Right. So you crave it and you like it. That's why you're there. For me, I feel like it's a necessity.
Mm.
Like me and my husband have had conversations about there's this amazing job in like somewhere Wisconsin or Oklahoma, right?
Or Vermont.
Make all this money and have a mansion. What do you think? And I'd be like, no, I need this place. I need a place like the Bay Area, like New York City, like LA. Like, this is who we are and this is where we're going to be comfortable.
Hmm.
I'm going to call you on your privilege right there, like you said earlier.
Hey, I'm fully aware of my privilege. I just thought, well, again, this is my privilege saying, but I'm kind of like, man, we kind of need you in Oklahoma, though.
No, that ain't going to happen. That's not going to happen. I'm sorry to everybody who's in Oklahoma. Yeah.
So
next question, please.
No problem. So you mentioned, how many kids do you have?
I have two daughters.
Two daughters. Mm-hmm. Do they get back to Sudan at all?
Yes, we go to Sudan. We try to go to Sudan every 2 years or so.
Mm-hmm. How old are they?
She's going to be 16 next week. So 16 and 12.
Oh, wow. So
the 12-year-old is about the age.
I was about to say, you're going to steal her and take her?
No. So I was going to say, yeah, she's about the age that my parents, it's a very different America right now than where they were. And also me, Yanni, I just said Yanni. Yanni is Arabic. I don't know why. I'm comfortable, I guess, with you. So they were the immigrants, and I was kind of I always get mixed up with first generation and second generation.
Your you were first generation. Well, I guess I don't even know if it's technical because you have to be quote born here, and technically you weren't born, but you were here.
First generation is somebody who was like born here. The first generation born here, not the people that came.
Correct.
Got it. So they were the immigrants, and I was the first generation. So right. we just had very different experiences, right? Growing up, also, but also it's a very different time. Where my daughters are surrounded by people who look like them, who have the same, you know, parents telling them the same kinds of things. And I didn't grow up with that. And I think I was coming home with these, you know, like I said, with attitude and with things that were very foreign to them that they became afraid of that is not present here today. So the answer is, I don't think so. I don't think there's a need to do that anymore. We have a great community. Grandparents and aunts can come visit anytime. So, Yeah, it's always a hard question for our community. Almost every time we get together, there's this question of,
when are they coming?
Are you going back? You know, people buy land back home and start saving up to build the house on the land that I have back home. 15 years later, 20 years later, they're still here. So are you an expat or are you an immigrant?
Yeah, I don't know what that line is.
You're an immigrant. I mean, for me, it's like the expat mentality of I'm going back, therefore maybe not buying a home, right? Not setting down roots in this country. But the immigrant is an immigrant, right? There's communities here that say, we are not going back. I'm going to bring all my family here, and this is where I want to be. This is where I want my children to be. And that's it. I'm going to buy my house. I'm going to do this. Sudanese have had a hard time with that, just like determining what they are. And I don't know. For us, we've determined we're here. Like my family didn't, right? My family kind of goes back and forth still to this day. But it's tough. It's hard.
I have one. I'd like to maybe finish on one question that I keep hearing in my head, especially when I listen to your show. You've talked about, and I've heard on the show, the nomenclature African American, and you'll say Sudanese American.
Mm-hmm.
Are you African American or are you Sudanese American? The reason I ask is, like, I think I kind of understand what's happening, but I don't have the language for it. And I'm hoping you can kind of set me straight, because even though you are from Africa or your family is from Africa, calling yourself African-American or labeling yourself African-American has a whole lot of weight going on. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of almost hear the conscious decision whenever I hear you say Sudanese American, like there's some kind of line there. Can you explain that to me?
For sure. Yeah. For sure. I think the term African-American is meant or reserved for Black Americans in this country who are the descendants of enslaved people. And that is who that is. When I come as an African to the U.S., that I don't think that makes me an African American. I think maybe it makes me an American African. But for sure, I don't think it's my right to call myself an African American, because I think that term was reserved for that group of people with its own history and culture that I deeply respect. I always make sure my daughters also know that.
I was just going to ask if that also translates down to the next generation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my father, when he came here, you know, it was 76, and you know, he was. I remember his library was full of, you know, Roots and all of these biographies of Black leaders, and he was fascinated by the Black civil rights movement. He always made sure that we knew that if not for this struggle by these people who were here, there was no way we would have been able to come to this country. And you learn it and you understand it and you respect it, and don't try to pretend to be it. don't get on a bandwagon. Don't do any of that, because that, I think, it just like minimizes something, I think it's just respect to say, you know, this is a group of people that went through this, and I don't want to take any of that away from them.
It's interesting. It's almost like a migration experience underneath the migration experience. You've got the coming to America thing, but then even within the community that you might feel some kinship with, if I can use a word.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. There is still this bifurcation that's kind of you don't quite fit in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of a central theme. That's kind of one of the reasons why we started The Stoop, is me and Leela, who is African American, she's Black. You know, we would find kinship, as you said, and have these common opinions about a lot of things. But then, and then we'd not have common opinions about a lot of things. And, you know, this kind of, but when you see us in society, maybe me with the scarf, maybe not so much, but if you see somebody from Africa and somebody who's African-American on the street, for you, you know, there's no difference, right? You just see a Black person. But we were discovering all these little things that made us different, and we loved that, and we loved them. And
I love them, too.
You know, and the idea that Black is not a monolith. Like, when you see somebody who's Black, don't assume what they are. Don't assume who they are. We come from the same origin, but we're very different in a beautiful way, I think. But yeah, I mean, for me to say I'm Sudanese is also important because that is what I am, and I'm proud of it. And for my daughters, yeah, it's, they know they're not African American because African American means something different.
Wow. Well, I love, we could talk for hours on this because I just love the conversation, but thankfully you've recorded hours of your podcast, The Stoop, which I can go back and re-listen
to. Go listen.
Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. Thanks
Absolutely.
For coming on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, there you have it. Please check out the show notes for links to more information about my guest and to reach out with questions, feedback, and interview suggestions. Don't forget to subscribe and to leave us a like on your favorite podcatcher. Migratory Patterns is a production of Migration Media and is executive produced by me. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.